Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, Evolokimab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show I talk to director Lorcan Finnegan about his new Nicolas Cage starring movie The Surfer, where Nicolas Cage becomes a survivalist in the pursuit of the perfect wave. The controversial filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl's story gets retold in a brilliant new documentary called Riefenstahl. Plus, Donald Trump's mission to make Hollywood great again. We talk to Gene Mattis of Variety about his plans. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you're doing well and you've continued to enjoy some clear skies all week long. Lots of people were in touch with me last week and this week and continuing so about the Four Seasons on Netflix, and largely everybody enjoying it immensely and saying what a fun, sweet, sometimes sad show it is. So I'm glad most of you agree. Not everybody. Some people said it was nonsense, but hey, that's the democracy of this show. Now, this week in TV, I was watching something pretty sweet again.
I'm going through my mom, I know his recipes. And then I realized food is love. So I want to open an Italian restaurant. What are you, crazy?
Who are you going to get to come down and cook?
Nonas. Other real-life Italian grandmothers.
I am from Bologna. I spit on Bologna. Spit on Sicily, okay?
That is a clip from Noni's. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's the Italian word for grandmother, or maybe an Italian colloquialism for grandmother, if I'm not mistaken. And this is based on a true story where Vince Vaughn, as you heard there, wants to open a restaurant. His mother has passed away. He's been left some insurance money. He's at a bit of a lost end. So he wants to create a restaurant that will ape the food of his mother and his grandmother, his Noni. And he comes up with this idea that the chefs will be Nonis. And they are. And we have Lorraine Branco of The Sopranos in there. Susan Sarandon is in there as well. Brie DeMayo who played Adriana in The Sopranos, is also in. She plays the wife of Vince Vaughn's best friend. It's all about his realization that he wants to open this restaurant and then his attempt to do it, from getting the food right to getting the correct permits. He wants to open it in Staten Island, away from Manhattan, in this kind of neighborhood place. As I say, it's based on a true story. This is sweet. It's a little cheesy, like Parmesan, if you will, but it's very sweet and warm. And it has a lot of Italian food in it as well, which is fine by me. You feel hungry watching it. You feel like eating a big plate of well-seasoned pasta. Vince Vaughn is delightful in it. He brings a charm to it because he is a pretty charming guy. And so this is a pleasant watch, a Sunday afternoon kind of movie that'll put you in a good mood, I have to say. So Noni's getting a kind of thumbs up from me from Netflix. It's there now. It's a movie. It's about 2 hours, if I'm not mistaken, or 1 hour, 54 minutes. I'm saying that without notes in front of me, so I'm hoping that's the case. But it's a watch that flies by, which is a good sign. So that's Noni's on Netflix, all about Vince Vaughn opening an Italian restaurant and getting grandmothers to be the chefs, or certainly trying to. Now, something I have to mention on Netflix that is also out this week is called Deadly American Marriage. And it tells the story, story we're very acquainted with here in Ireland, about the killing of Jason Corbett in America back in 2015. It is a one-parter. It's a kind of mini movie, less than 2 hours long. And you may have well heard about this in advance, but you have the people who were initially convicted of his murder, then changed to manslaughter, Molly Martins and her dad Tom in it. And very importantly, we also have Jason Corbett's children, and Jack and Sarah, who were 10 and 8 at the time and are now young adults. You know, I've said to you before, whenever we watch true crime documentaries, you're in essence making a deal with the devil, because you are allowing yourself to be entertained to a certain extent by a murder, or several murders. So whether it's Making a Murderer or Gabby Petito or any of this slew of true crime documentaries over the last year, that's what you do when you sit down to watch them, because at source you're saying, I know someone or many people have died and I'm going to watch the story of this. And this is very hypocritical, and I'm completely aware of saying that, but it's harder to make that deal when it's the case of Jason Corbett, I think, for an Irish person, for an Irish audience, because it feels more personal. So I don't know what to tell you about this show, as in whether it should have been made or not, and if we even should be watching it, because we probably know the story quite well. What this does is interview everybody involved, and importantly, gives Jack and Sarah their chance to talk about the effect that the killing of their father had on them, and just what brave young people they are, and how hard their lives have been, and how they are attempting to move on and yet remember their father. So that documentary has to be complimented for this, and also their aunt and uncle, Tracy Corbett Lynch and her husband David, who are now the legal guardians of Jason's children and have given them some solace in a pretty difficult time. It may sit uneasy for many Irish people to listen to Molly and Tom Martins give their defence. So this is a difficult watch because of the subject matter, and particularly for Irish people, and particularly you can ask yourself, are there any new things to be gleaned from this? I'm not telling you to watch this or not watch it. I'm telling you it's there. It's called A Deadly American Marriage. It's very important to say that the Corbett family wanted to be involved in this because they wanted to show, you know, how difficult the American justice system was on them, and that's why they took part in it. And everybody involved in this, from defense attorneys and prosecuting attorneys, are consulted and interviewed. So it's there for you to stream on Netflix. Do let me know what you may have been watching. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, this is not a political show, and in fact, we go out of our way to stay out of all that stuff. However, one of the big movie stories of the week and possibly the year does certainly involve politics, because as you may have heard, President Trump announced a plan on Sunday night to slap 100% tariffs on foreign-produced films, prompting a slew of questions in Hollywood and, of course, a lot of questions over here on this side of the water, where we make a lot of movies, as you know, which we talk about every week. So to help me make sense of this, we go back the other side of the water, and I'm joined now by Gene Mattis, reporter with Variety, as I say, to make a little sense of it. Hi, Gene, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. So listen, Gene, like, you know, there is a danger in, and particularly in media on this side of the world and in some sections of media on that side of the world, to automatically just go, Trump's being a moron again, he's ruining the world. So let me play devil's advocate and say, is there any benefit from how you see it to this happening?
No.
Okay.
to be brief about it, no. But, you know, sometimes he does, if he comes up with a sort of crazy solution, it's not because there's no problem there. I mean, I think he has sort of put his finger on a problem that potentially exists. It's just the solution is not something that anybody who knows anything about this would have created.
Yeah. So, but the problem that he may have identified is that too many movies are being made overseas. Is that a problem?
Well, it's certainly a problem from the perspective of people who make movies in the U.S.
Yeah.
They feel like, you know, a lot of people are out of work, been out of work for a couple of years. There was a strike, you know, obviously, and people have really been struggling for the last couple of years. And they look around and they go, well, all these movies that I used to work on are now being made in London or Toronto or wherever. And they're naturally look to their elected leaders and say, do something about it. Mm. And so this is sort of a reaction to that.
Yeah. But isn't it a lot more, you know, there are many channels to this. So, for instance, Ridley Scott, who I spoke to before, made his last movie or the movie before Napoleon, The Last Duel, here in Ireland. And I said to him, why did you make it here? And he very humorously said, because of the tax. But when you actually look at where it was made, it's from a few different places. So the financing, for instance, came from all over the place, not just Ireland and not just America. It's very diversified in terms of where movies are made. So is he not like hitting a hammer at a problem that's much bigger than he realizes?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely complicated. I mean, obviously, like a lot of movies shoot overseas for extremely legitimate reasons. You know, the setting is overseas and you want to make the movie where it's set. Like that makes sense. I think the concern that people have is more along the lines of, you know, the UK government is offering a 40% tax incentive to shoot something that could just as easily or in the past have been shot in Los Angeles. And the producers are just going to chase the incentives and they're going to go wherever they can get the best deal. And so just, you know, pragmatically, the U.S. should be competing with that and should be in that games to sort of level the playing field. That would be the argument from the perspective of somebody looking for a job in Los Angeles.
Yeah, okay. So look, I mean, if Hollywood agreed that there is a problem, that a lot of, you know, movies are being made overseas and we should bring some of that cake back home, which I, you know, maybe you can't argue with that, and certainly people in Hollywood wouldn't. But yet, Hollywood, as far as I understand, but you tell me, don't want to go about it this way.
No, no. If it were up to, you know, the leaders of the studios and the leaders of the unions, it would be a national United States film incentive that, you know, created something akin to what they do in Canada, what they do in Ireland, what they do in the UK, other places. You know, if you film in the US, you get 10% back or 20% back from the government. And that's what they would want. Mm. Now, is there a political coalition that can support that? Not yet. Maybe there will be someday, but there isn't today. And instead, what Trump is offering is, okay, well, you know, I have this power of the tariff that I've used in many other contexts and enjoy using and used unilaterally all the time and at my own whim and pleasure. And so I'll just slap a tariff on it. And that is not what, I mean, we're talking about tariffing US-based companies that shoot overseas. Yeah. It's like shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, obviously movies are not tariffed traditionally. And so you'd have to come up with some mechanism to do it. Yeah. It's not like there's a port of entry where everybody has to declare their movies and pay a tariff. I like that. It just, there's a lot of practical, there's a lot of legal obstacles to doing this. So it's just sort of an idea you'd come up with sort of off the top of your head as opposed to after a rational policy process.
Because he's slapping tariffs on everything else. So why not make Hollywood great again when he's making everything else great again? Would seem to be the logic, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, it doesn't cost the government anything, so it's beneficial in that way. And in fact, the government would make money if they figured out a way to do it. So, but it just, you know, it doesn't compute. It doesn't make any sense.
Now, we've experienced this on this side of the war and here in Ireland. He's talked about tariffs. They haven't always come to pass, or certainly in the fashion he initially intended. Like, is it possible this will get very watered down when he does initiate something?
Well, they immediately backed away from it. So he said this on like Sunday night. And then by Monday morning, they were already saying, well, no decisions have been made. And then he came out and said, you know, well, I don't want to do anything that would hurt the industry and I'm open to whatever. And, you know, so they already sort of backpedaled away from it. Does that mean it won't come back in some form? Like, I guess it could.
Yeah.
There's no constituency for it, but, you know, he doesn't necessarily need that. He could just do whatever he wants. And I guess, you know, he could impose something and then people would end up in court trying to stop it. Mm,
yeah. Let's see what happens in that one. And has TV been mentioned in terms of, because there's a huge amount of productions. And I know from the Irish locales, which we see all the time, a huge amount of American TV is made overseas. Has that been mentioned?
So Trump's initial thing was, he was talking about movies, which was sort of a very, like, in a lot of domains, he seems to be very stuck in the 1980s, and this would be one of them. Like, the TV business is so much bigger than the movie business, you know? And so a lot of the complaint that people have about runaway production, they call it, is about television. And, I mean, maybe even a majority of the complaint is about television. So I think in this sort of more expertly crafted version of this, it would certainly apply to TV, but we haven't gotten the expertly crafted version of it yet.
No, we haven't. And just, I caught wind of this. He has a triumvirate of Hollywood advisors. Am I right? In the form of John Voight, Sylvester Stallone, and Mel Gibson.
Right.
And they've been invited to the White House. And are they behind this?
Well, John Voight is the one who's really, like, to his credit, doing the heavy lifting of actually going and meeting with people and gathering ideas. And he's come up with this sort of white papery kind of thing that is not 100% crazy, that has different ideas, you know, incentives and bring back, you know, certain, you know, extend certain tax credits and you know, incentives like that. And tariffs was sort of a small piece of his overall proposal. Mm. So he's been working. I haven't seen anything from Gibson or Stallone. And in fact, Gibson is making a movie in Italy. So, you know, he's sort of part of the problem, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there is sort of a version of this that's sort of a little more coherent. But again, it's sort of a far cry from actual policy making.
Yeah. And I suppose the worry is that if something like this, albeit a much more structured idea and one where, you know, you got 10% reasons to stay in America, like in terms of cash flow and stuff like that, is the danger, though, that a lot more superhero movies would be made and American audience would see less foreign films and you'd stop being a nation of cinephiles? Like, is that a worry or would it just not work that way?
I mean, the whole thing is so hard to game out because it just doesn't make sense on its face. Yeah. So it's sort of like, I mean, one concern would be, would other countries then slap tariffs on American because obviously, like, from the American point of view, movies are and TV is a tremendous export business. Like, we're sort of the world's sort of dominant cultural power in that way. And other countries would have much more to gain than we would from a tariff system on movies. But the problem is, like, even coming up with, like, how would they do it? Like, it would just be as cockamamie for them as it would be for us. So, you know, there's just sort of, it's sort of hard to debate something that's sort of ridiculous on its face, you know, like, what would this do? What would that do? It's like, well, it wouldn't do anything because you can't do it. So, you know, if they came up with a way to do it, it could have some impacts, but it feels like, you know, an idea that a guy came up with on a Sunday and has already forgotten about. Yeah. And maybe he'll come back to it and maybe he won't.
Yeah, well, look, we will watch this space with interest, no doubt. Cockamamie seems to be the takeaway word here. But one thing that remains a stalwart of the movie business here and indeed in Hollywood is Variety. And I've been talking to one of its reporters, Gene Mattis. Gene, thanks for taking the time.
Yep, happy to do it.
After the break, a brilliant new movie called The Surfer, starring Nicolas Cage. And we talk to its Irish director, Lorcan.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.
Finnegan. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now opening in cinemas this week, everywhere, a very big release is The Surfer, which tells of a man's return to the idyllic beach of his childhood to surf with a son who's also, this is the man, he's hoping to buy a house and return there. He's hoping this house and the new home will fix all of the problems in his work and indeed his life, only to realise that he's not welcome to this place that used to be his home. And he's seen as an intruder by some locals, the Bay Boys, who tell him it's locals only. The man in question is played by Nicolas Cage. And he starts to confront, and a serious conflict arises with these Bay Boys, and it becomes something of a survivalist tale. And it's also dealing with topics of, you know, I suppose, toxic masculinity and about even modern capitalism, if I may be so bold. It all takes place in a very sunny-looking Australian coastal town. It was written by Thomas Martin and directed by Lorcan Finnegan, who we've spoken to before for his previous films Nocebo and Vivarium. Vivarium, which we fondly remembered in the company of Jesse Eisenberg back in January, who couldn't remember that it had been 6 years since he last made it. But I haven't spoken to Lorcan in person in studio, but I'm delighted to say he joins me now to talk about The Surfer and a bit more. Besides, hello.
Hi, how's it going? Good to see you.
You too. So listen, I'd say everyone's asking this, but I do have to ask, and we can get over it quickly. Getting Nicolas Cage is great for all sorts of reasons, but I presume it's not that easy to do.
Well, I mean, I don't know what it's like to not get him. So,
bum bum.
I mean, it all worked. But we took our chances, you know, and we sent him the script via the usual channels, yeah, through his manager and everything, and he read it and liked it, you know, that, and he'd actually seen Vivarium before.
Oh, okay.
Which is good. So he was like, oh yeah, this is by the guy who made that. And he liked the title, The Surfer. He grew up in California. And he's like, oh, I'll give it a read. And he read it. And he really liked the script and the writing. And it gave him a kind of Kafka-esque sort of vibe.
Yeah.
And the character was around his age, and you know, he was thinking, Nick actually was thinking about buying a house by the beach in real life, which he actually subsequently did after the
film. In America or Australia?
In America, he bought a house in Malibu. But yeah, he really liked the material, and then he went and watched Nocebo and he liked that, and then he said, okay, let's jump on a call with this guy, and then I got on a call with him.
Was that an awkward Zoom meeting or one of those?
Yeah, an awkward Zoom meeting, yeah.
Which obviously hit it off.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. No, he's a cool guy, very into film, you know. And he's funny and he's into the same kind of, you know, we have a similar sense of humour, similar taste in cinema. And he totally got what I was trying to do with the script. And he was up for it. He's also up for an adventure. You know, I think because we were saying, oh, we're going to shoot this in like a remote little place in Australia, he's like, great.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Yeah. And is that where you shot it? Because that's exactly what it looks like. But it's a remote part of Western Australia.
Yeah. It's around 3.5 hours south of Perth. Mm-hmm. A place called Yallingup.
Okay.
Which is like a smallish town. You know, it'd be like a, you know, a little village in West Cork or
okay.
Castle Townsend or something.
Okay.
Had like a couple of, like a hotel, I think, and a couple of shops. And yeah, that's kind of the size of it.
And do, you know, we hear about places, we'll get to the movie in a second, but, you know, we see in Barcelona and places, Basta, you know, tourism stop, and there's a touch of that in Venice and other places as well in the Canary Islands. Is this trend happening in Australia where there's certain locals only places, particularly for surfing, or maybe you didn't get into that?
I mean, it does exist in Australia for sure. Yeah, there's like the documentary made by Russell Crowe about the Bra Boys years ago.
Okay.
And it exists, and I've heard about it in Portugal, in Spain, and I mean, you know, anywhere I suppose that has a really good surf break, and if there's locals who like to surf it and don't want to see tourists rocking up and getting in their way, they can become very territorial.
Yeah.
And then they protect that area. And that's what was sort of interesting with this. It's like these guys, these bay boys in our film are very, they're kind of corporate. They're, you know, dentists, doctors.
And they take lawyers. Off the suits in the evening. And
exactly. Yeah. But once they're down there, they're much more tribalistic and animalistic. And, you know, this character played by Julie McMahon, Scally,
sort of
almost like a cult leader.
We get more about him and that he might be some kind of trying to bring men back to manhood or something like that. There's shades of that in it.
Exactly, yeah. There's all that sort of masculinity in crisis.
Yeah. You know. There's a lot of masculinity in crisis. And so for people who haven't seen it, Nick Cage goes up against the Bay Boys and doesn't take no for an answer. And in tandem, his life, it's hinted at. Well, it's maybe made plain in some ways. His life is kind of falling apart. He's divorced. Probably a bit of heat from the boss he's working for as well. I'll get to it tomorrow. He's obsessed with his own. But then it goes in the direction, and I don't want to give spoilers or anything, almost of a survivalist movie, because he's going to go up against these guys. And he starts living in his car and it becomes this, I was going to say David and Goliath, but they're both quite David-y like in a way. But it becomes this great kind of battle of wits with the sun baking down on him. Was that when you read this, you thought there's lots of places I can go with this?
Yeah, exactly. What was fascinating to me is it's like a guy who has everything together. He seems like a successful, wealthy businessman. Mm. Drives in
initially
in a Lexus.
Yeah,
exactly. He's trying to buy this house, but then you start noticing the cracks.
Yeah,
that he's obviously, his marriage is failing. His son doesn't want to spend any time with him, and he's focusing all of his attention on this materialist goal of like buying his childhood home back. Then it'll fix everything. But then he kind of ends up going on this almost Jungian journey over a few days where he has to be stripped of all of his material wealth in order to kind of find himself. And that's not by choice.
Yeah.
It's like part of the process of what the guys do to him.
Yeah.
There, you know, which is fascinating for me to enter into the character's psychology and tell a story that's completely like a subjective POV film. So we never cut away to any kind of objective truth. We experience the film from Nick Cage's character.
Yeah.
He's only called the Surfer.
Yeah.
His experience of this. So we learn what he learns and we experience what he experiences, which was really interesting to make and quite challenging, but also good fun, because you can really kind of play, you know, he becomes an unreliable narrator, so
yeah,
you can start messing with people's minds.
Yeah,
the audience goes on that journey too.
Absolutely. It's such a brilliant journey. And I get what you're saying about Jungian and psychology and all that, but I would want people to be aware that this is really entertaining.
Yeah, no, it's very fun.
It's a great watch as well, but those themes are in there. And he gets increasingly desperate, and it just seems to, and we won't go too far, right? But there are rats and things like that and eating, well, maybe I won't say that, but there's awful stuff in it, right? But it seems to me, if you want a man who's going to look at masculinity falling apart, Nick Cage is probably the guy to do it. Like, he's probably 101 for that.
Yeah, that's the thing, because he's an incredible actor. Like, there's not very many people who can do drama, comedy, action.
Mm.
And this film has all of that. He has to carry all of that,
yeah,
you know. But he's also got, like, a really interesting face to watch during the film. And he gives a very physical performance as well. Like his actual journey on the film, he really transforms about like five times across the film.
There's probably something going on, you know, we talked about Jungian psychology, but something going on about materialism or the capitalist way being at the end of a road, or we need to get back into the water or something like that. But we're not sure who's proposing that, be it Scally or be it Cage. But is that one of the themes of the film, do you think?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, you can't serve if you don't suffer. So it's almost like he has to suffer if he ever wants to serve. And that becomes, that's their mantra.
Yeah. He is brilliant in it, as I mentioned. It's quite male heavy, and I'm not saying that's a problem, but there is possibly the only person who shows him any kind of kindness or warmth is a female photographer who's kind of passing through. And unfortunately, I don't know the name of the actress, Miranda, but you're going to tell me.
Miranda Tapsell.
Okay, wonderful. She shows him kindness. So again, with a different lens on, was that purposeful that the main woman in it was the nice lady in it, like a Sean O'Casey play or something where the only good characters are
female?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And she's indigenous.
Oh, yeah.
So she's the only actual local.
Yeah, okay.
In the movie.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
And she, you know, she kind of appears as almost an apparition, you know, the second time, and kind of helps him confirm something about his identity.
But was it your choice that, like, I don't know, in terms of, you know, diversity and movie making stuff, that it's such a male heavy story in terms of the characters, were you keen that she be the good character in it, or was that just an accident of casting?
No, yeah, we wanted a moment of kindness to come from somebody to him, you know, and she sort of represents that, which was sort of missing, you know, just to balance the film as well. But it's kind of a film about men.
Yeah, I know.
And about male stubbornness, ego and identity and all of these kind of things, you know. So, we knew, like, when we were proposing to make it that could be an obstacle. But it turned out not to be at all, really, you know, because women really enjoy the film as well.
Yeah.
Especially because there's a lot of attractive men in us.
Indeed there are. Indeed there are. And look, it's a great watch and it's gripping. It really is. And what I was saying to you before we came on air, what I like about it is I thought once or twice, well, only at one point it was coming up to verging into daft and you pulled it right back, which I think is brilliant, you know? So it's a terrific ride. Tell me this. I presume, I mean, what else can you say at this stage? But I presume Mr. Cage is happy with the way it turned out, because it's been out a while and it's getting great reviews.
No, he genuinely loves it. He actually told me he wouldn't change a frame.
Wow.
He thinks it's a piece of art.
Okay.
You know, he really loves it. He's gone to see it three times, brought his family to see it last week in LA. So I got to meet his two sons, and no, he loves it.
Do you surf?
I have surfed. I wouldn't say I'm a surfer. I've like attempted to surf, and I thought that I would have loads of time in Australia to learn how to surf.
Doesn't work out that way.
For 3 months, you know, and I got out maybe twice and just kind of got thrown around in the waves. I'm not very good, but I'd like to be.
Tell me this. I mentioned Vivarium. I have such fond memories of that film, and I'll tell you why. And this is a name drop. But I said that to Jesse Eisenberg because I spoke to him for a real perm earlier. But when Vivarium came out, for people who don't know, it's this weird story. Imogen Poots and Jesse Eisenberg are kind of in almost this ghost estate. It's a suburban sprawl. It came out during lockdown. I didn't know who we were going to even talk to on this show anymore. And I remember getting you as an interview and just thinking, this is such a strange dovetailing of events. We're talking about this movie where people are stuck in this estate and we're all locked in our houses.
Yeah.
Are we going to have a show anymore? It's just a crazy time. And I was talking to Jesse Eisenberg and he hadn't ever thought of that. And I just realized, well, I guess he made it in 2019, so it never occurred.
Exactly. It wasn't our plan. We didn't.
No, it wasn't meant to be prescient. But he was, like, not that he stopped the interview, but he was so shocked by how prescient that movie ended up being when it came out. I presume you were equally shocked.
Yeah, completely. It was fortuitous in a weird way that, you know, it was one of the few new films that was available to watch.
Yeah.
Suddenly, it was supposed to be in cinemas and then cinemas closed down like 2 days before it was supposed to be released.
Yeah.
So then it went on streaming.
And was your initial thought, oh, sugar, this isn't making it to the cinema? Or did you ride the wave, to use a surfing analogy?
Yeah, exactly. I rode the wave. I mean, there's nothing you could do. You know, ultimately, we were very lucky because we had a premiere at Cannes and it had like a really good festival run, had good press and everything. And then people ended up watching it at home. I mean, the option of watching it in the cinema wasn't available.
Yeah.
So at least it reached an audience, captive audience, literally.
And it had a big life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, because people were stuck at home having these sort of existential thoughts, it kind of, it resonated. It really stuck with people.
Yeah. Well, listen, back to The Surfer. I read a review, but it's described as an instant cult classic.
Yeah, I hope so. That's what we're going for.
It's kind of an oxymoron, though, to have an instant cult classic.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it has that vibe. And you know what I thought once or twice? The Hitcher kept coming into my head.
Oh, yeah, it is a little bit The Hitcher, yeah.
Even though you don't go in a car necessarily, there's something Hitcher-esque about it.
Yeah, I mean, we're inspired by a lot of new wave Australian films that Thomas Martin, the writer, and I love, you know, like Nick Rogue's Walkabout, mm-hmm. Ted Gottschalk's Wake and Fright, or, you know, Peter Weir's early films like The Plumber and mm-hmm. The Last Wave. And they're kind of like unusual films that you'd kind of end up accidentally watching when you're about like 12.
Yeah. And maybe when you shouldn't have been.
Exactly, yeah. And they stay with you forever. So we kind of wanted to make a film that was reminiscent of that period, except in a contemporary setting and with contemporary themes.
Well, look, it's absolutely brilliant. It is in cinemas from the 9th of May, which happens to be Billy Joel's birthday, you'll be pleased to hear.
Right, happy birthday,
Billy. There's a really happy dovetailing of events for you, I'm sure. It's getting a very general release, which I'm delighted to see. You should go and see it. It's terrific. It was directed by Lorcan Finnegan, who was in studio with me. Lorcan, the best of luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Dude, that's my board, and I want it back.
Mate, I think you've been out in the sun too long.
They took it from me last night. Threatened me with a broken bottle.
Why don't you take a drink of water?
I don't want anything from you. I want my board.
So you're saying they took this from you last night?
Was I not clear?
Well, it's just the problem is, and I can tell you myself, that old board's been up there for as long as I can remember. How long?
I reckon we put it up there maybe 7 summers back now. She's a beaut, isn't she? I guess it's like a talisman for us. What the f*** is this?
A clip there from The Surfer, and I loved it. It's a brilliant watch. And you heard me there talking to its director, Lorcan Finnegan, in studio, chatting about The Surfer, which is on release from now, the 9th of May, which, as I mentioned, also happens to be Billy Joel's birthday. After the break, something very different, a new documentary about possibly the most controversial documentary maker of all time, Lenny.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.
Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, filmmaker and Nazi propagandist Leni Riefenstahl is considered one of the most controversial figures of the 20th century. Her films, and in particular Triumph of the Will and Olympia, are defined by their, well, let's face it, fascist aesthetics and the celebration of all that is superior. Now, what's interesting is Riefenstahl, who first began as an actress, spent decades after the war kind of denying her association with Nazi ideology, distancing herself from it, but sometimes making counterclaims about the value of art for its own sake. So how did she become the Reich's most prominent filmmaker? Riefenstahl examines this question using never-before-seen materials from Riefenstahl's estate. And there are literally hours of material that have never been seen before that have been worked through. One of the film's producers is Sandra Maischberger, who is one of Germany's best-known political journalists and also a talk show host. And over 40 years, she's interviewed everyone from the German Chancellor Scholz to Angela Merkel to even Leni Riefenstahl herself. And I'm delighted to say, having spent so long in the archive, she joins me now to talk about Riefenstahl. Sandra, hi, how are you today?
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm fine. Thank you for putting a light on this film.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you something. Like, I would have heard about Riefenstahl over the years in college and things like that. And what we were told, even before we saw her movies, was she was this filmmaker who kind of got hired in by Hitler to make these, albeit aesthetically interesting, movies that celebrated these horrific Nazi parades and anti-Semitism and stuff like that. And then she spent the rest of her life kind of denying any culpability. Is that a fair assessment of who she was?
No, of course not. And that was my question after leaving the house, after 2 days of interview with Leni Riefenstahl. That was exactly my question. Was she an opportunist, you know, a career woman who wanted just to have the funds for her filmmaking and asking Hitler for this? Or was she intrigued in the ideology? And what I found out now, after going through 700 boxes of estate, is that she was much more a fascist even before she got to know Hitler. So she selected him in order to get to know the man who shared her ideas. And so eventually they got together and they were a perfect couple, because he needed someone who would put him into scene. And she was just really a fascist and a national socialist in her core. So that was a perfect match.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that, because I asked that question kind of as a devil's advocate, because I've watched the film and it's a fascinating watch. But in a way, your film puts a full stop to this idea that she was brought along, that you're saying, look, she was a Nazi from her head to her toes.
Yeah, that's right. And even before the Nazis were in power, that is very important to know, because she did an interview in 1934 with the Daily Telegraph, I think it was, no, a Daily Mail. And she admitted that she read Mein Kampf already 32. Mm. And from the first page, she was an enthusiastic Nazi. So after the war, she would always say, yes, I was fascinated by the person of Adolf Hitler, but I was not political, and we can prove her wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I mentioned 700 hours of an archive, and there are some brilliant moments in this. Like, one particular thing you unearth is where she tells people to stop filming, and she is vitriolic with the interviewer. And, you know, there is moments like that where it's kind of spine tingling, where you see the real, or certainly a little known, side of Leni Riefenstahl. But like 700 hours, I presume you were like a detective going through all this stuff.
Yeah, it was 700 boxes, and not so many. The most part of it was really material, which was paper.
Yeah, sorry, I should say 700 boxes as opposed to hours, but boxes. I'm sure it took more than 700 hours, actually.
Yeah, much more, because we started in 2018 to go through the archives, and everybody thought that she's a good archivist, you know, that she keeps things in place. This is not true. We found many things that weren't where we suspected them to be, and many very funny things. For example, after the war, she edited the Olympic Games film, and she had to cut out all Hitler's in there. So she had a box where she kept all the outcuts with Adolf Hitler. Why didn't she throw it away? Because she wanted to, you know, promote the film internationally after the war. So Hitler, he had to disappear from the film. But she kept all these outtakes in a box, and the box had the sign saying, this is with A-H. Aha, A-H, Adolf Hitler's initials.
Wow.
And we thought, why did she keep it? Maybe she thought that there will be a time in the future where she can just insert Hitler again in the film, because her time would be come again, and the Nazi ideology would come again.
Wow. So she was keeping those reels of Hitler for when the moment might rise again. Fascinating. Tell me this. I mean,
I say it's pretty unequivocal about, you know, she was a Nazi first and foremost. And I don't mean to have a laugh in my voice, but it's just kind of, it's very strange when you consider she dedicated her life or her the second part of her life to getting away from that or weaving a narrative. But your film does show, and I don't want to say excuses, but her dad was pretty rotten to her. There's a moment in the documentary you talk about, he throws her into the river and or to the sea or a lake, and she has to learn how to swim. Her mother kind of was a stage mother in the old sense of it. You also uncover, you know, she was treated pretty horribly as a woman by high-ranking SS members. Are you in any way sympathetic to stuff that might have happened to her in her life that could explain why National Socialism appealed to her?
It's not about being sympathetic. It's about understanding. And, you know, the way she was brought up, it was the way everybody was brought up at this time. Most of the children of this time suffered really. They were beaten by the parents. And there was this ideology of you have to be strong. You have to, you know, be strong enough and don't be weak. So we wanted to understand why she came in a state of mind that made it later so easy for the National Socialist or for the fascist to have her and many others and millions of others in Germany following them. So that was something that we wanted to put in the film so it would be easier to put her biography in the context of history.
Yeah. Where do you stand now on, say, Triumph of the Will? I mean, I mentioned I saw it in college. Like, is it, I mean, we can't rewrite the past, but do you think we should still watch Triumph of the Will for any aesthetic value, or should we just watch it as an accident of history? Or, I mean, should it be shown in schools for aesthetic reasons as opposed to educational reasons?
Well, the thing is, we are watching the new Triumphs of the Will every day. Go to the movie theaters and you see, for example, Dune Part 2. There's so much Triumph of the Will in it that I think it's very good for the generations now who don't know who Leni Riefenstahl is, or maybe even are about to forget what the Nazi Party did and what crimes they committed. I think it's very good to know that if there's a dangerous part in all the beautiful pictures about strong people and the strengths of the people, and there's always a second part in it, which is the denial of the so-called weak. And I think that's a warning. Watching this film and not being seduced by it is something which is so difficult today, because it's all over the place, and we are facing a time where the ideology is just getting back. White supremacy is coming back, and fascist ideas are coming back. So I think now it's even more important to watch where it comes from.
Sometimes I see rallies, particularly in America, with thousands of people in them, and they don't seem wildly dissimilar to, you know, Triumph of the Will. I'm sure I'm not the first person to make that association to you. Yeah.
No, and what we heard, you know, Leni Riefenstahl taped her phone calls. So she's talking to people who are supporting her, for example, on the phone. And there's one conversation, we put it in the end of the film. There's one man saying, you know, it will take two generations maybe, and then we will be back to the old strengths and where we were before. And she says, yes, that will happen. And because the German people, we have the will to do that. And two generations from there, it's right now. So I think that we are living in a crucial time for what's happening to our societies. And for me, this film about Riefenstahl is not so much an historical piece. It's more a comment of our present and maybe a warning of our future.
It just popped into my head there, but I remember Oprah interviewing Michael Jackson in the mid-90s, and he had released this movie, a short movie for History, his album. And she was pointing out to him, people have mentioned that looks very like Triumph of the Will. Has anyone ever mentioned that to you, that Michael Jackson may have aped this?
Well, what we found in the archives, we didn't put it in the film because the film is already pretty long.
Yes.
When she celebrates her 100th birthday, there's Siegfried and Roy visiting in Germany, and they are bringing the best wishes of Michael Jackson.
Wow.
They read it out loud in front of the camera and say, this is Michael Jackson admiring you. So she had many fans internationally, and Michael Jackson was one of them.
Good heavens. You met her and interviewed her. What was your sense of her as a person? I mean, you know, I talk to film stars a lot, and I say occasionally you get why they're film stars. They change molecules when they walk in the room, and maybe it's a placebo or something, but sometimes you're in the presence of people and they do affect you. What was the effect she had on you, just person to person?
Well, there was a woman who was about to be 100 years old, walking through her house, showing me her editing rooms where you would find the old editing machines, you know, from the 20s of the last century, and the newest ones, you know, the way we edit films nowadays. And she was capable of going through all these things. And so she was very much awake, full of energy, even if she was already a weakened elderly lady. But there was something, of course, about her, and I would love to have her as a role model, because in the 1920s, she conquered the world as a woman, a man's world. And that would have been, I really would have loved to admire her for doing that. On the other side, being a political person, I knew exactly that she was lying to me all the time. And it was clear that she was lying. The only thing I didn't know at this time is she lying to me? Or did she lie to herself so many years that she now doesn't know the difference between the truth and the lie? But there were some fascinating aspects. But on the other side, there was no interview. She was acting. Yeah. I never got through. I left the house and I thought I found the perfect perfect actress, in a way, acting her life the way she wanted me to believe it was.
Absolutely fascinating. As is your film that you were producer on, Riefenstahl, which incidentally is also a great watch and a great film, and it's just brilliantly put together. I was absolutely fascinated by it. Riefenstahl is getting a release in Ireland the week ending the 9th of May. I've been talking to its producer, Sandra Meischberger. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Sandra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sandra Meischberger there, talking to me about producing the new documentary Riefenstahl, which is now in cinemas. And it's a brilliant documentary. It's so well put together and it's a fascinating tale. And yeah, well worth a watch. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com and let me know what you may have been watching on the big or the small screen. I'll leave you with a little music from the movies, and we haven't played this in a long time. This is the Jesus and Mary Chain from the closing of Lost in Translation. This is Just Like Honey. So I'll leave you with that and wish you a happy remainder to your week.